Hey there, Smartsies. You're going to hear in a moment that the audio quality on my end is terrible, but we catch it real quickly, so it's all good from that point on.
Gregoire and Dan Beeston are smart enough to know better.
Episode 210 of Smart Enough to Know Better.
We are a podcast of science.
And comedy.
And ignorance.
I'm Dan Beeston.
And I'm Gregoire.
And in this episode of Smart Enough to Know Better,
I'm going to put my hands around you and start to squeeze.
And also, the moon rocks.
And I will yoke golden tails to science. But first, Dan, what happened to you this week in science?
I got myself a flu vaccine.
Ooh.
I am protected, shielded against the flu. One of the flus. One of the remaining flus.
Three. But I think it's three of them, isn't it? When you get them, they get the three most prevalent strains and then they whack it in you.
Like they just roll the dice to figure out which one's the best one. So I got the flu, and where do you get the flu, Gregoire? Where the flu shot?
Sorry, where do you get the flu with the flu shot?
No, where do you get the flu shot?
Anywhere, like pharmacies and doctors, and the guy down the street is like, "Hey, man, you want something fun? I can give you something fun." And you go, "Sure." And then you wake up without a kidney, and he goes, "I gave you the flu shot." And you're, "Thanks."
The answer I was looking for is the shoulder, but I appreciate your enthusiasm.
Thank you.
That was on me. I should have made that clearer. So the upper arm in the shoulder. And I was thinking, what happens if you get like 8 cc's of liquid and just stick it into the shoulder?
Please don't tell me you did this. Please don't tell me you stuck 8 cc's of liquid into your shoulder.
Oh, well, I mean, they did. That's the flu shot.
Yes. Okay.
I didn't put anything extra in there.
Good.
That feels like a mistake.
Yeah, I was about to say that seems dangerous. Okay, brilliant. Good. Phew.
I mean, I imagine saline would be all right.
Look, who knows what happens? Human body is a terrible, terrible...
My own blood? I can take blood out of one shoulder and put it in the other. Get some bruising, I guess.
No, God, no, everything feels... No.
Heroin? Heroin's supposed to be injected, right?
It can be, yes.
That should probably go into the back of the eyeball, though, right?
Of course, that's where.
Is that how that works?
That's where everyone sticks it under the fingernails. I've upset myself then.
No, fair enough. Well, this is what happens. It floods between the muscle fibers.
Ooh.
Now, muscles are great for vaccines because muscle needs plenty of blood flow because, you know, it needs all that oxygen because it's doing all the stuff. Like all the other stuff in the body doesn't really do a lot of stuff, but the muscles do a lot of stuff. So they need lots of oxygen, need lots of blood.
Yeah.
Now.
Oh, and well, muscles also are breaking all the time. That's how they kind of get bigger and stronger. So they have to repair themselves quickly. Therefore, they need a blood supply to do that. So unlike your bones, which don't break all the time, I hope, they don't have the same amount of blood supply because they don't really need it.
I do hear a grinding sound whenever I like move. Is that my bones?
It's the frog princess's teeth.
Yeah, no, that checks out. The blood transports immune cells into muscles really quickly because they come in the blood. Now, if you put a vaccine into fat, then it would just sit around and do bugger all. Mm. Now, immune cells crave antibodies. They find the vaccine and they suck them onto their skin and then they slip into the lymphatic system. So what we want is lots of immune cells with the vaccine stuck to them to gather all in the same place.
I just realized, I think you sound quite tinny.
Son of a bitch. Oh, you piece of sherbet.
The squad cast is, it's I'm looking at it and it says, yeah, microphone set up, Rode Podcaster V2. Glad you caught that, though.
Yeah.
Still a stupid thing. Okay, so... what we want is lots of immune cells with the vaccine stuck to them to gather in the same place. Shall we say a lymph node?
Mm.
Well, there's one of those just north of the shoulder in your armpit.
Ooh.
With lots of immune cells gathering where all the T and B cells are, the immune system has a great opportunity to get really to the bottom of this riddle and start manufacturing antibodies. One of its solutions is to create inflammation.
Ooh.
This means that the location of your injection gets inflamed for a day or two. That shows that the immune system is doing its job.
It it's I always like that idea. If you rocketed it in like a shot that was like a big wide shot there down to a close shot, you just feel inflammation and you just kept like, ah, it was like killing everything. Everyone's fighting each other. Like, oh my God. That's just strewn corpses everywhere.
Yeah.
The best.
It's war.
It's war. What's it good for? Keeping me alive, ironically.
If you were to inject the vaccine into the bloodstream, it would dilute across the whole body really quickly. Mm. Much of it would be destroyed before it was able to be taken up by immune cells, and those immune cells will be spread across the entire system, and they kind of need to be together to work better. If you put it into tummy fat, then it wouldn't meet immune cells at all, and they would just sit and stagnate. Mm. So the shoulder is a great location.
Why not the butt? The butt's like a big, sexy muscle. It's going to have lymph nodes all around it in the crotch area.
Yeah, then the pain would be in the lymph nodes next to your groin.
Mm.
So do you want to complain about the pain in your shoulder now? No, I didn't think so.
Okay, fair enough. Unless that's your thing. That might be your thing.
Oh, it might be my thing.
I've never been a very big hugger.
I'm not much of a hugger myself.
Yeah. I think people would know that about me. People would go, oh, yeah. In fact, I have friends of mine who will come at me from either 10 or 2 o'clock and sort of sidle in sideways because they think it's going to make it better. It just makes it feel weirder. It makes it even weirder. Just hug me, for God's sake. Or don't. Just don't hug me. Or say, can I have a hug? And then that's fine. And we negotiate it. And that's okay. But yes, hugging. So hugging is a thing that mammals like to do and many animals like to do.
Bears?
Oh, yeah, that's true. They got the whole hugging type named after them. Some scientists from the Netherlands were looking into the power of hugging. And they looked at 212 previous studies, a meta study. We do love a good meta study here on Smart Enough to Know Better, where they look at all the results from other people's studies. Look at
Facebook. Yep. They get all their information from Facebook. That's a meta study, right?
That's what it is. No. This is actual peer reviewed studies, and it gets rid of all the issues all the time, but it can clear away. It'll show commonalities and get rid of the outliers because they get more and more data. The 212 previous studies looked at, are hugs good? And if they are good, then what are they good for? And the answer is yes, hugs are good. They're great. In fact, the human body is like, we need it for our physical health and we need to be touched for our mental health as well. I don't think that's even strange to acknowledge. I think everyone listening is obviously human touch. We're a social mammal and we need to be touched sometimes. And those who don't get touched at any point grow up to be kind of weird and strange creatures. It's probably good to be touched sometime. But how much does it matter? Here's the question.
Yeah.
13,000 participants across 212 studies.
That's a big hug.
Everyone's just so much hugging. It's disgusting.
Oh, it's freaking me out. It's making me sweaty thinking about a hug that big.
Touch was shown to help reduce the feelings of pain, depression, and anxiety, and the positive effects were observed in both children and adults. Damn it. Okay, fine. So here's what gets interesting, though. The type of touch from hugs to massage doesn't actually matter, it seems. So it's not the hug.
Mm-hmm.
It's being touched. Yeah. And here
is like a hand job? Was that in the study? Good old hand job? Say. That feels like that would be more beneficial.
It doesn't say. No evidence doesn't equal that. They're not true. It just means we just don't know, Dan.
Where are these studies done? Can I sign up?
Yeah, more science is required. Anywho, it doesn't seem to matter too much the type of touching, but touching on the head or face appears to work best. So when you hug someone, hug their head and face.
Pat, 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 pat.
And shorter and more frequent touches get more positive reactions. So if I just walk up to you, Dan, and just start going like this, I'm your best friend.
Hopefully that's coming through because I can't hear it.
Oh, you can't. Okay. Oh, bloody hell. Really? You can't hear that tapping?
Not at all.
If I walked up and tapped you rapidly on your face, Dan, I'm not being an annoying person.
Like this?
So if I come and tap you on the face and you get that sound, then I'm actually helping you a lot, Dan. I'm being a hero. So the next time someone says, would you like a hug or can I hug you? You can say, sure, but I intend to, in reciprocation, to help you more, tap you on your face rapidly, very rapidly, with my pointy index finger.
This is science.
This doesn't sound right at all.
And it sounds terrible, doesn't it? But supposedly that's it. The response to touch will vary a lot from person to person. So it's not saying that everyone wants to be touched all the time. And it really needs to be as consensual as possible. I think that goes without saying as well. But yes, what's really interesting is your physical health will get affected by being touched by an inanimate object. So if you rub yourself with a plastic finger or something, which this is now starting like an OnlyFans account.
I beg your pardon?
If you had a plastic, like a mannequin hand and you touch yourself with it, that will help you physically, but not mentally. They're saying that it does. It looks like it needs to be another person or an animal or something else to give you a proper mental boost.
Oh, so I can pick up my cat and rub myself with my cat.
Yes, exactly. Yes, as long as it's consensual, that's the important part. Your cat has to want to be there to do that.
I don't think the cat can give consent. That's why you're not supposed to fuck them, right?
Is that the only reason, Dan? I don't think that's the only reason, Dan. I'm hoping...
I think it is the only reason.
I'm hoping that's not the only...
Like, if your cat can give consent, then you and the cat should be able to... Like, I don't want to yuck your yum.
Don't bring me into this. I was talking about tapping someone on the face over and over very quickly, not whatever the heck you're talking about. It's getting weird now. I have to add that to the study, I guess.
Yeah. I think that's an outlier. That's another outlier. Hopefully.
I hope it is.
I've been thinking about my legacy, Gregoire. Ooh. I don't have kids. I'm not a big celebrity. I want a way to live on and...
Hang on, whoa, 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 whoa. We do a podcast that goes out across the planet. What do you mean you not a celebrity?
Yeah, well, the atmosphere goes out across the planet and it is also quite thin.
Nicely. Wow. Oof. See, that's why you're a celebrity. Look at that. A big brain on you.
No, it's not enough. I want a way to live on in humanity's mind after I pass on to that great hole in the ground. So what's the best way to do that, Gregoire?
Fear.
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 That's good. That's not what I have.
It's definitely fear. You'll be remembered a lot longer if you make the world fear you.
Well, you're going to like this.
Yay!
Because I'm going to make a gigantic statue of myself that will stand for eons where people can look upon my works. Now, where on earth can I build a statue where everyone can see it? If I build it on the North Pole, the people who live on the equator won't be able to see it because the refractive properties of the atmosphere make it look like the Earth curves away as if it were on a sphere.
Wait, what are you talking about?
Well, you know how if you're at the equator, you can't see the North Pole because when you look out, the atmospheric refraction makes it look like things dip over the horizon.
Yes, no, they do dip over. Wait, what's going on now? Hang on a minute.
So I'm not going to build on the North Pole.
Good.
Okay, I'm going to build it on the moon. Then when everyone looks up, they will be able to see me, ye mighty and despair. Now, getting to the moon, Gregoire, is expensive.
Yes.
Just getting me up there is going to drain our Patreon account. Listeners, if you could step up, that'd be great. But
send Dan to the moon.
But failing that,
please.
How can I build my statue up there? Taking enough concrete up to the moon is going to cost an absolute fortune. Concrete is, by its very nature, really freaking heavy. Nope, I need another solution. Aluminium is light. You can mix things like pumice into concrete to create lighter materials. Though I'm worried about it standing up to the wind.
But it won't be. There's no wind on the moon.
There's no wind on the moon?
No wind on the moon. There's no atmosphere on the moon.
Oh, great. Pressure's off then. Rim shot. Then you do the rim shot. Okay. I have found the perfect construction material, Gregoire. Moon dust.
I was about to say, the moon is made of giant rocks. It's a rocky body. Why are you taking anything to the moon?
Well, it's all dusty. It's regolith.
Not all dusty. It has a level of dust on it, but it's quite a solid object. You don't just sink into the moon forever.
You don't. That's where the eagle landed.
They will say that, yes, when humans went there, there was actually a passing thought of, we're not terribly sure how deep this dust goes. Like, it could go very badly very quickly, but it didn't, because it's not. It's fine.
Well, I don't need to pay to take the bulk of my building material with me, Gregoire.
Good. Good.
I can just make it when I get there. The trick is to turn that moon dust into bricks. Mm. Now, we turn dust into bricks all the time.
Well, it's all I do. But every time Dan calls me, I'm turning dust into bricks. Oh, you don't mean you don't ask.
I don't mean Dorito dust into poop.
Oh, wow. Okay, fine.
Concrete blocks are a mix of cement, sand, and gravel. Mix it with water, and you've got a slurry that can dry into bricks. But if I'm on the moon, then number one, cement and sand are heavy, and number two, water is heavy, Gregoire.
Yeah.
Number three, if your concrete dries too quickly, you get cracks, and drying slowly is hard when all of your water boils at room temperature. But scientists have been beavering away to solve my problems. More than a dozen techniques have been used, creating all sorts of regolith-based materials, and they break down into four processes. Reaction solidification, melting, bonding, and confinement. Right. So, reaction solidification involves mixing the regolith with reactive compounds. The compounds go from one state to another, and they attach to the regolith surrounding it. That creates a chemical reaction that results in the regolith affixing to the product. The regolith itself doesn't necessarily change, but it is all connected now. Ooh. So if you've got, you know, that glue that where you get two bits and you put it together.
Oh yeah, yes, yeah, like a epoxy resin, two sorts of resin that you join together, one of those sort of ones.
So they're just sticky goo, and then you put them together, and they're like, oh well, now we're going to have a chemical reaction, and we're going to form something new that is like hard.
Mm.
So that mixes in with the regolith, and the whole thing turns hard because all the regolith and the oxy stuff are all stuck together.
Got it, yes.
So that's pretty good, but you still need to get your goo up there. Mm. But you're looking at like 95% regolith, 5% goo. Now, melting involves heating it to 1,100 degrees Celsius where it can bond together. That's expensive energy-wise, but it's not expensive. You know, you don't have to carry stuff up there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because you have all that solar energy, you have the sun and no atmosphere.
Yes.
And you could parabolic mirror and melt that son of a bitch.
You might need more than that, but you might need to like store that solar energy up in order to like release it all at the same time. But yeah, you've got the right idea there. But so if you can get your energy costs down, then you are laughing. Or you could bring some resin up and melt it at a lower temperature and the regolith sticks to the resin. So that's kind of like a hot glue gun.
Sure. Yep.
So sintering is a similar process, but it doesn't melt to liquefaction, but it does melt enough to bond the particles together. You know, if you get snow and it's like all loose and fluffy and you like push it together, the pressure increases the temperature. And it sort of bonds together, and then when you release the pressure, it's sort of cold. It's like a cold brick, sort of like a snowball.
Yeah, but you're not allowed to do that. You're actually legally not allowed to do that around Christmas time. You're not allowed to take snow and crush it together because otherwise you're going against the Santa Claus.
That may be the best joke you've ever told.
Thank you.
That's fantastic. I mean, I didn't laugh, but I was delighted, like because there was so much lead up. You saw it coming like a train.
Oh, did you really? Oh, okay, fine.
Like, not the punchline, but I knew there was a punchline coming.
Oh, yes, yes.
Like there was something about that setup.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've also got your bonding. So this is where you get some sort of cold glue and glue it together.
Right.
And there are all sorts of things you can use as glue. See episode 119 of Smart Enough Know Better for details. And your fourth way of constructing material is confinement. So you grab a sack and you fill the sack with regolith, and then you've got a big heavy sack that you can use as a building material. The highest rated technique is the bagging. It's 99% regolith, and it's fast and easy to do. It will probably be used for most of the construction of habitats on the moon, but I obviously need to go much taller and skinnier to make a statue of myself.
Absolutely.
So sintering and melting works well. Like it's the second best way of doing stuff. And you can even use solar energy to heat these things up, as you pointed out. So my plan is to melt the regolith into magma and then cool it into my beautiful visage on the moon. Then wherever you are on this earth, you can look up and see the top of my head. Despair.
Farmer Dan, you and I have been married now for many years. And I am sick of being poor. Dan, you're a gentle lover. You're a good man, but we have to be positive. So
it's the only way I can love when I'm across the room horrified. That's as gentle as it can be.
While I tap you on the face over and over again. Now, but I have a plan. It's an easy snatch and grab. We're going to break in. We're going to take everything from inside and we're going to be rich. Rich, Farmer Dan. Rich!
Sasquatch or Bigfoot, who is who? It's all going down at the Crypto Zoo.
I speak, of course, of Aesop's fable, The Goose That Laid the Golden Egg.
Is that... So that's a different thing to the giant Jack and the Beanstalk.
Yes. Yes, it is. There was also a goose that laid golden eggs in that too, but I'm talking... It doesn't actually matter.
Maybe it's a sequel.
Maybe. Look, if this is popular, we can always come back and do it again if we want to.
Great Uncle Jack told me he got that goose from the top of a beanstalk for stealing it from a giant, but he was quite senile.
Yeah. What's the story of the goose that laid the golden egg? What's the basic idea?
We found a goose, and then one day, and it just laid normal eggs, and then one day it laid a golden egg. Like, holy dooly, I got a solid gold egg. And we're like, this golden egg is fantastic. All of our dreams are going to be. And then the next day, it lays another golden egg.
Yep.
Another golden egg. We're like, oh my God, this thing is full of golden eggs. It's like, oh, hang on, but we have to wait every day. Another egg.
Yeah.
And the thing is, a goose egg is quite a big object. If that was made out of gold, that would be worth a fortune.
I can tell you exactly how much it'd be worth if you want to know. So an average golden goose egg would be 2.8 kilograms of gold, valued as of today at $322,000 Australian dollars.
No, that's not enough. That's not enough. I want it all right now. I want millions of dollars so that I can actually buy real estate in Australia.
A small flat. A modest flat.
I have a great idea, Gregoire.
What's that? What's that, Farmer Dan?
Well, I mean, this goose, it must have stacks of golden eggs inside it. Let's just cut it open and pull all these golden eggs out of it right now.
It's science, damn it. Exactly.
Let's get all the golden eggs all at the same time.
Yep. And make a proper
because
investment.
I'm a farmer and I obviously have no idea how geese work. This story has always, ever since I was a kid, first time I heard this story, I'm like, what the hell are they talking about? Obviously, eggs grow inside the animal.
They break open the goose, of course they kill it, and they find no golden eggs.
No golden eggs because they grow inside the goose.
The goose. And so the moral of the story, of course, is don't be greedy, be thankful for the good things come in your life, and don't look a gift goose in the cloaca. So Dan and I... We were together in reality one day, and we were drinking. All good stories start. Dan and Greg.
So reality asterisk.
That's right. And we started thinking about this golden egg problem, and suddenly, we could do it as a crypto zoo. And I decided to take this on.
I don't remember this.
Oh, yes, that's exactly how it happened. We were drinking. That's what happened. You were drinking more than you thought you were drinking, which is exciting. It was at your home.
Oh, this is where you bought a bottle of red wine to my house.
Exactly.
I haven't had a drunk red wine in a long time.
He started drooling then when he said red wine. So that's quite terrifying.
Brain's having a flashback.
Love it. All right. So I had to start thinking, all right, so how does this... Let's think of this, what we know about this story. How can we make this actually happen? How could you have a goose that could lay a golden egg? That's what we're trying to create here.
Well, you can't make gold you need to do it inside a star.
That's the first step. Let's look at what we know about this story. It laid golden eggs, but when they cracked it open, there were no golden eggs inside it.
Yeah.
So the gold is not always there. No. And so there has to be a point where it's making gold, or it's laying down some gold. Something's going on there. The process,
or it's imbibing small amounts of gold and then accruing them together. Yes. Like if it was drinking like Olympic swimming pools of seawater, like many of them a day, and filtering it all that out.
You've kind of hit on something there. We'll get back to that, actually. Just hold that thought for a moment. We'll get back to that. So the first thing I was thinking of, well, maybe it's a nuclear goose. Maybe it's a fusion reactor, and it's taking normal items and it's turning it into gold.
Nuclear goose sounds like an indie video game.
Yeah, or the coolest new title in the next Top Gun movie. Nuclear Ghost, you're clear for landing. Dun, dun, dun. So it's, yeah. But that's ridiculous, though. You can't have fusion reactors at the body temperatures of an animal. It really gets really, really hard really quickly. You could have a fission reaction. It's possible to have a fission reaction in pretty low.
So the goose's rage, like, compresses its
not
food.
Enough, unfortunately. Not enough. So I started looking for ways of depositing metal in the body. The crocodiles have something called osteoderms, which are bony bits of outcroppings on their skin that make up their armor, the scales and plates, osteoderms. And they're actually created by something called an osteoblast, which you have in your bones, that actually create more bones. When you have breaks and things, it turns the cells into bone. But it's not metal. Osteoderms don't take metal and put metal into things. So you can't lay the metal down through an osteoderm or an osteoblast.
Now, I do have some metal in my body.
Yes.
Like, I need the iron in my blood.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just looked it up, and a person has like 0.2 milligrams of gold in their body.
Yes.
So how much gold is in a goose?
Not well, less than that. It's a small amount of body.
Or more gold per body weight.
Maybe they do. The osteoderm thing, the osteoblast, is a type of what's called biomineralization. So it's taking, in this case, calcium used in bones and other minerals and depositing the skin to make armor. But it's a type of biomineralization. So other animals do actually do biomineralization, and not just calcium, but types of metal. So calcium, magnesium, even iron can be incorporated into certain body structures. So the scaly-footed gastropod utilizes iron sulfides in its shell, gaining protection from predators. Like, gives itself an iron foot and an iron shell.
That's neat. Didn't I talk about a jellyfish in a prior crypto zoo that made a skeleton out of something?
Yeah, we're talking about D&D, the jelly. One of those jelly monster things. And it had the same refractive index as the jelly as the bones, basically, the silica-based bones. So you can see right through it. So the other one is the one you just mentioned before about bioaccumulation. So accumulating of substances such as metals over time through their diet or absorption through water. We do that all the time. Is that your iron has to come from somewhere. You put things, you have to have bits of copper in your diet. All these things are just absorbed. There's bioaccumulation. It's normally very, very small. But mollusks and crustaceans can accumulate heavy metals like copper and zinc in their tissues. So there's something there. Like, well, maybe it's just eating a bit of gold. So limpets actually make a magnetosome formation to make a hard little spike that they can actually dig with. But that's made of metal, which is interesting.
What? They got a magnetic spike?
So certain bacteria form what's called magnetosomes, which are intracellular nanoparticles of magnetic materials called magnetite, iron oxide. These bacteria use these particles to orientate themselves, aiding navigation.
Pigeons have a bit of magnet in their head.
Yeah, some birds do. That's magnetosomes. Then there's structural reinforcement. So some, which are, you know, they add metal into their structure as well. So marine snails, the limpet, a marine snail, can make a tooth-like feeding structure, which is actually incorporates iron to make it harder as well. So it's bone, but it's got iron in it. That's structural reinforcement.
Wow.
And finally, there is detoxification and storage. Sometimes when an animal lives in a very harmful environment, it evolves a way of locking up the harmful thing away from its sensitive parts. So it's not necessarily a great thing to do, but it's a way of storing up horrible, horrible stuff.
Gold's inert. So
gold,
is it?
Is inert, chemically inert, but gold, we've talked before on the podcast, gold is very good at killing bacteria. Very, very nanoparticles of gold, like silver, is very, very good at killing bacteria.
The oligarchic effect.
Ooh, there you go. Ooh, I like that.
That's what that is.
We said before about if it was a normal-sized goose egg, it'd be 2.8 kilograms of gold, because gold is ridiculously dense nearly 20 grams per cubic centimeter. It's very much, much denser than water. That means, we said before, if you have a goose egg, which is 145 cubic centimeters, so it's bigger than a chicken egg, roughly a third of $1 million. But that's 2.8 kilograms of gold that this animal has to create. That's a lot of gold, right? So I was like...
What you should do, what the farmers should do if they're really eager for that gold, is to put it on scales and wait for it to increase by 2.5 kilos and then just squeeze it.
Yeah, but this is the thing. I was trying to work out. I couldn't work out.
Is this the lesson to learn from the fable?
It's too much. It's too much gold for me anyway. I was looking at going, no. It's too much, too heavy. That's too much gold. We're talking about an animal.
I'll take whatever's left if you want. If you're worried about there being too much gold, I'll take the remainder.
As in, it was too much gold for me to try and create out of the animal's body, or where was it coming from? Where was it? It became very difficult. So I said, well, maybe the egg is just has the shell is gold. Maybe the egg is a normal egg and the shell is gold. Okay. So I had to then calculate what that meant. So as goose egg is about 0.3 millimeters of thickness, the shell does. So when you work that out, it's about 5.2 cubic centimeters of eggshell. So that means there's about 100 grams of gold per egg at that point. So that's still a lot of gold, 100 grams. And seeing the egg is only 150 grams, roughly, that's almost doubling, not quite doubling the weight of the egg. It's too much gold, too much gold. So I was trying to get this down to something that seemed reasonable. None of these seem reasonable.
Now, the thing with gold, because there's a thing called gold leaf.
Ah, yes. Well done.
And you can buy it, and it's like two atoms thick or something, and then you just brush it onto stuff.
Excellent. Exactly. That's exactly where it got to the same point as well. So how much gold leaf do you need on a white surface like an egg to make it look fully gold?
Couple of kilos?
No. It's about 1 micron. So about 0.001 millimeters deep on a white surface will make that surface look golden.
Okay.
It's a tiny amount. Tiny amount, right? Really, really, really small. When you do all the maths again, so on an average goose egg, this would mean a gold leaf volume of about 0.017 cubic centimeters, which is about 0.03 grams of gold, which is much more reasonable per egg.
0.03 grams
of gold. Excellent.
Well, I've got 0.2 milligrams of gold.
Oh,
so that's still a lot of gold.
That's still quite a bit of gold. It is, right. Yes. But not. It's now getting to an area I can control. Here's the downside. That's great, but that means now if you have 0.03 grams of gold, that means each egg is only worth $3.45 Australian.
Oh, well, I mean, how much does a goose egg cost?
Like
a normal
one. $3.45.
But it looks like it's solid gold. You might be able to sell it to some schmuck on a bridge and get yourself a bunch of beans.
Exactly right. Chickens lay 200 plus eggs a year. Chickens all the time, constantly, forever laying eggs. You know,
yep.
Geese have seasonal times. They only lay eggs about 4 to 5 months a year. They lay between 20 and 50 eggs. So if the farmer and his wife or his husband is only getting $3.45 per egg and they're only getting 20 to 50 eggs per year, you can see why they wanted to kill this goose. They were just like, look, let's just give it a go because we're making nothing. We're spending more money watching this bloody goose than we are. Like, you have to buy security for the goose. That's going to cost me more than $3.45 a day. Like, it's a loss leader. Like, it's I can see why they went for it. It's not quite, they're not so greedy anymore. It was like, oh God, I hope there's more gold inside this goose because this $3.45 a day we're making is just nonsense.
So where's the goose getting the gold from though?
I'm glad you asked. All right.
I'm glad you're glad I'm asked because that means that you've also got a bit for this bit.
Yes. Oh, thank God. So our story begins deep underground where a seam of gold lies hidden beneath a lush green forest. Water goes through the cracks and crevices of the rock, slowly eroding the gold stream, and a tiny gold particle is dislodged from its resting place and carried along with the flowing water.
Mm-hmm.
As the particle moves through the rock, it's ground down to even smaller size, becoming a nanoparticle suspended in the water.
Okay.
And the particle encounters our golden goose. This goose...
The goose is not golden.
Sorry?
The goose is not golden. It's just a normal goose.
Look, I think it's golden to me, Dan. It's just because...
It's emotionally golden.
It's emotionally golden goose. This goose, it's the common greylag goose. It's a pretty common-looking goose. It's a grey-looking goose. And geese are known to tolerate high levels of heavy metals in their diet.
This is important
to know.
Yep. We'll get back to this. This very normal looking goose, but we'll get back to about whether how normal it is.
It's a common goose.
It's a
so it's not sort goose. Of upmarket.
No. It's a grey lag goose. It's a pretty standard
not a proper
goose.
Gander.
No. You can have a gander, but it's still a common goose.
Right.
The gold nanoparticle is inadvertently swallowed. It begins its journey through the bird's digestive system. Mm-hmm. I say inadvertently, but really this has been going on for a long time with this species, subspecies of grey lag goose.
Mm-hmm.
This brook is a massive concentration of gold in it. It's so much gold. It would be very, very dangerous for most animals because other heavy metals are there too. This goose has evolved to survive in this heavy metal environment.
Yeah!
Inside the goose... It's a... Golden goose! Emotional golden goose! Inside the goose's crop, which is the pouch in the throat where food is stored before digestion, the gold nanoparticles encounters a unique cousin of a real bacteria. The real bacteria is called Cupria vidis metaldurans.
That sounds like the title of the album we were just singing.
This is a real bacteria, but the one that's encountered inside this goose, I'm calling Oromicrobium aeneris. It's a cousin to this. This C. metaldurans does not live inside geese, but this other one I've made up does. It's a variant of a bacteria that already lives in a goose.
All right.
So C. metaldurans was first isolated from the sludge of a zinc factory, and these bacteria have evolved to tolerate high levels of heavy metals, including gold, and can even accumulate these metals within their cells. So how our A. anseris gained its gold-handling abilities is a fascinating example of horizontal gene transfer, a process by which bacteria can exchange genetic material with each other and even other organisms. This happens a lot in nature.
Yeah. We got all sorts of stuff going on in us.
Sideways, all sorts of sideways gene transfer. Yes, it's awful. So in the soil near the gold deposits, a population of C. metaldurans bacteria has been thriving for countless generations, doing really well out of this very golden saturated water. Remember, the bacteria get killed by gold nanoparticles, so they get wiped out. This one doesn't. This one has worked out a way of surviving. So it's thriving, developing an array of genes that allow them to resist and even accumulate heavy metals like gold. Over time, some of these bacteria have come into contact with other microbes in the soil, including those that are regularly ingested by the geese, as they forage for food. During such an encounter, fragments of DNA from the metal-resistant genes have been transferred from our metaldurans bacteria to the goose gut microbe through a process called conjugation. In conjugation, two bacteria come into direct contact and form a bridge between their cells, allowing DNA to be copied and transferred from one bacteria to the other. All this means that we now have a gut bacteria inside the crop of the goose that can absorb gold and not die from it and store it up. In this unique environment of the goose's gut, this ability provides a significant advantage, allowing the bacteria to access a new food source, the ingested gold particles, and protect themselves from the metal's toxic effect. Over many generations, the gold-resistant bacteria have become more and more specialized inside the goose. They've also become an integral part of the goose's digestive system, forming a symbiotic relationship with the avian host. So taking all the gold and heavy metals out of the water that it's drinking. This bacteria is using the gold as a food source, as an energy source, and taking it away from the goose can't hurt the goose and other heavy metals. It's a happy symbiotic relationship.
Great.
All right. Now, when a gold particle is swallowed by the goose and enters the digestive tract, quickly encountered by our bacteria, and these bacteria bind the gold particle and internalize it with a membrane vesicle, just like the real one does it and basically keeps it away. So as the gold particle drifts by, our bacteria latches onto it using a specialized protein on its cell surface. These proteins, called metal-binding peptides, have a high affinity for gold, help bacteria to capture and internalize the particle. Once inside the bacterial cell, the gold nanoparticle is enclosed within a membrane vesicle, and a membrane vesicle are a small spherical structure that bud off from the cell membrane, are used by bacteria for various purposes, such as transport of molecules and disposal of toxic substances, such as gold. In this case,
it takes in the gold and it's sort of, it's benefiting from something that's the gold, but the gold is a waste product still.
The gold, once it's kind of used, you don't want it touching the side of your bacteria, otherwise you'll explode. So it kind of wraps it up into a safety container. Yes, a sheath. That's right. And so it's no longer can't hurt itself with it anymore. The bacterium uses the vesicle to safely sequester the gold nanoparticle and prevent it from damaging the cell. Then the bacterium uses a specialized efflux pump to expel the gold-containing vesicle from the cell, helping the bacteria to maintain a tolerable level of potentially toxic substances such as heavy metals and gold.
Mm-hmm.
So it pumps out the gold, basically.
So it poops out gold.
It basically poops out gold. So now you have a gold-containing vesicle that's expelled by the bacteria into the digestive tract of the goose.
Yep.
The goose can't be hurt by it. It's kind of concentrated all those nanoparticles down into a slightly larger, still very small, but slightly larger amount. And then now it's centered on its way into the rest of the goose's digestive tract. I thought at this point I'd solved it. This was the answer.
Hmm.
It's not. Oh. All right. So this is a very hard
cool.
problem
I'll just
to solve.
Edit out the last 10 minutes then. That's fine. That's
No. That's an important part.
Oh, okay.
Of it.
Okay.
Important
okay
part.
Yeah.
So because now you have to get the gold back into the digestive tract without being in the vesicle. That's okay, because a goose has what's called a gizzard. The gizzard is a muscular part of the stomach that grinds food particles with the help of small stones and grit.
Mm-hmm.
It lifts those, and it grinds up, and it breaks open the membrane vesicle, releasing the gold nanoparticle into the goose's intestinal tract. So it's gone from its prop through its digestive system, like its stomach,
mm-hmm.
then it gets broken down, and now the gold nanoparticle is available again to be used. They couldn't have damaged anything on the way down because you don't want it to damage things.
Yeah.
And it's not being toxic, but now it's back in the intestinal tract. It's ready, okay? And it meets another bacteria. There is an actual bacteria called Delftia acidovarans. It's a soil bacteria that's known for its ability to precipitate gold from solution. So you can have lots of gold in liquid, and this bacteria can actually take it out of the liquid.
Ooh, that's handy.
Yes, especially what we're doing right here. Absolutely. And it can be used in gold recovery. In mining operations, they're starting to use this bacteria to go through the horrible, horrible solutions and pull out the gold from that solution. So this protein called deltabactin that is actually produced by this bacteria binds dissolved gold ions and reduces them to solid gold nanoparticles. And in our case, this has happened inside the intestinal tract bacteria, once again to horizontal gene transfer. So instead of this Delftia acidovarans, which lives in soil, those genes have transferred across into what I'm calling Oregenus Delftia. So now you've got a bacteria in the intestine. That whole job is to find gold, dissolve it down from its ions, and concentrate it into very large, comparatively so, chunks of gold.
Got it.
Our Oregenus Delftia bacteria recognizes the gold nanoparticles and uses their surface proteins to bind the gold nanoparticles and bring it close in contact with the cell membrane. Here, a complex sense of redox reactions take place in which the bacteria transfers electrons to the gold ions on the surface of the nanoparticle. As the bacteria continues to accumulate and precipitate gold, the nanoparticle grows in size. Eventually, the bacteria reaches their capacity for gold and begins to release the enlarged nanoparticle back into the gut. And what it does, it actually takes it to the edge of the gut, and it pushes it up this vesicle up against the gut, and the gut invaginates it. So it basically goes, oh, it's a horrible thing here, and it covers it entirely, and it opens up a spot on the outside of it, and it just ejects the gold. So it ejects the gold directly into the bloodstream.
The gold's in the bloodstream now.
So, yes.
You've taken it out of the food.
Gut. Yes, right.
Food pipe.
It's been protected. Inside the intestinal cell, there is a protein called metallothein, which actually is a real thing. And many animals and birds actually have it. We have it. And it can handle metals such as copper, zinc, cadmium, and mercury. And this actually takes the gold, pushes it right through the intestinal wall to get rid of it. And now it's in the bloodstream. The gold mixes with this metallothenian protein, and they're packaged into a special transport vesicle once again, and they're actually sent off their way into the bloodstream. So you have this gold metallothenian complex, which is very stable, but it has been ejected from the intestinal cell into the goose's bloodstream. So now you have this gold and protein mass together.
Mm-hmm.
This took a lot of conversations with a lot of different people. At this point, as the gold metallothenian complex circulates through the goose's bloodstream, they encounter a fascinating peptide produced by a unique fungus that have co-evolved within the gold-laying goose. So we have two bacteria and now a fungus. The fungus, which we're calling Orosporia natea, is a distant relative of a well-known bread fungus called Neurospora crassa. Neurospora crassa is famous for its ability to bind and accumulate gold particles from its environment. So you know lots of interesting chemistry, which we won't go into right now. So this version of this bacteria, this fungus, now lives inside this goose. So it has three separate gold-based adaptions, which makes sense because it lives in a very gold-rich environment. Mm-hmm. It's water. If it didn't do this, it wouldn't do very well. So odd mutations, but can actually happen. As the gold metallothenian complex passes the goose's digestive system, they encounter pepside. It bonds to the complex, forming an even more stable gold complex that helps to protect the gold particle from degradation and facilitates the uptake by the goose's cell. So it's wrapping itself more and more by this fungus into this thing that the body will actually acknowledge and won't hurt it, but can now start to use.
Okay.
The Gol peptide complex circulates in the goose's bloodstream until they reach the oviduct, which is the organ responsible for producing and shelling eggs. Here, a complex encounters a set of unique set of cells called the eggshell gland cells. In normal geese, the eggshell gland cells are specialized for the uptake and deposition of calcium, which is the main component of eggshell. These cells express a calcium-binding protein called calbindin, which helps to transport calcium from the blood with one of these processes to the eggshell gland gland cells. However, in our special golden egg-laying goose, a series of mutations has altered the calbindin protein to have a higher affinity for gold. But I was looking online and people have had these similar thoughts, which is interesting to me. The internet is full of weird stuff and it was all getting too complicated. But someone came up with an idea saying that the calbindin protein is actually a physical structure that can hold the calcium ions, which are only 100 picometers. Gold is larger at 137 picometers, the gold ions. So their idea was just to increase this mutation. All it has to do is increase the peptide from being able to handle 100 picometer ions to 140, let's say, picometer, and it could accept gold, calcium and gold.
Mm.
So I decided to steal that idea. Much easier. One mutation or a couple of mutations that lead to this peptide now being able to handle calcium and a larger gold. So inside the eggshell gland cells, the gold peptide complexes are processed and the gold nanoparticles are now released. The cells then use specialized transporter proteins to pump the gold nanoparticles into the developing eggshell. At this stage, the eggshell is still soft and malleable, consisting of a matrix of proteins and other organic molecules. As the gold nanoparticles are deposited into this matrix, they begin to aggregate and form a continuous layer on the surface of the eggshell. As the egg travels through the oviduct, the shell continues to harden and mineralize. In normal eggs, the mineralization process involves a deposition of calcium, calcium carbonate crystals, which give them strength. However, in the golden egg, calcium carbonate is supplemented by aggregated gold nanoparticles. So originally, this grey-legged goose variant would have had eggs with trace amounts of gold, but as the process became more refined through evolution, the eggs would have exhibited more and more gold streaks until they developed a predominantly golden layer interlaced with calcium carbonate shell layer. So the final step in the golden egg's formation occurs in the shell gland, where a protective cuticle helps to seal the pores in the eggshell and prevent bacteria from entering the cell. In the case of the golden egg, the cuticle already serves to protect the golden layer, giving a smooth, shiny finish, and the egg is ready to be laid by the goose, completing its incredible journey from a tiny particle to a gold seam to a magnificent, shimmering golden egg.
So does the gold, it's still got pores in it? It can still breathe? Or is it like that girl in the James Bond movie?
I think this originally I was looking at this going, hang on, could this produce a living young? And if it was entirely covered, then no. But if as long as there's somewhere for it, kind of like the girl, not that's a true thing, but you know, as in as long as there could be gas exchange, but the cuticle around the egg actually stops it from bacteria, stops things from getting in the pores anyway, inside the goose at this stage. So the answer is, if it was fertilized, then it would have probably a harder time of actually producing a living young, but it might be possible depending on how much gold is actually on the surface. If it's 1 micron thick, there may be still a channel for it. It still has pores, just pores of gold now instead of pores of calcium carbonate. Calcium carbonate is just there to protect it as long as the bacteria can't get in and it's protected. It doesn't need to breathe inside. Simple.
Yes, except that the egg is worth like $2 in gold.
$3.45 Australian.
$3.45 for the shell.
Yes.
And I guess like another 80 cents for the food inside it.
Yes, I guess exactly right.
Well, I've got good news, Farmer Greg.
Yes.
In the time it's taken you to explain this, I've actually raised the goose to like a full-size goose. You could sell those things for like $25 a pop.
That's pretty good.
We should just raise geese, Greg.
I think we're talking about the gold amount, but the fact that it's a bizarre creature that can make golden eggs, that would be worth more than the value of the gold.
I don't know. Geese is delicious.
Sure. I have one last question, though. Here's a question.
Although the fact that we've only just realized this probably explains why we're such poor farmers. We're
very bad farmers. Spend more time writing down weird science. Here's a question I was thinking. Is our golden goose, is it still a grey-legged goose, or is it something new? Like, how do we define this thing?
Well, if it, what happens if it has sex with an old, with a normal goose?
That's a good question. So if the Godland goose can interbreed with common greylag goose, Ansa Ansa, and produce fertile offspring, it would be considered a subspecies. And so in this case, we'd call it Ansa Ansa Aurum, with Aurum indicating gold. Ansa Ansa Aurum, mm-hmm. It's a subspecies. However, if the Godland goose has evolved significant reproductive barriers, such as different mating preferences or reduced hybrid fitness, it'd be classified as a separate species. So maybe other geese wouldn't like it, don't want to mate with, maybe it only wants to mate with people who produce golden eggs, and they would get speciated off. Then we'd have to give it a binomial name. So it wouldn't be Ansa Ansa Aurum, it would just be Ansa Aurum, recognizing the distinct evolutionary trajectory. But ultimately, more research into the goose-laying biology and ecological interactions would be needed to make a definitive taxonomic decision. That's what I'm going to be doing. You can keep raising geese, and I'm going to be watching to see if they like to get it on with other geese.
You can force-feed geese. That's how you get foie gras.
Yes.
So we force-feed it water, like this gold-soaked water, and get, like, thicker shells.
Maybe.
Could we get a bunch of geese, put them in cages, and force feed them water? This seems like a brilliant idea.
Go wrong.
I think we can make this work. Yeah, if you could squeeze 5,000 geese into a very small allotment, yeah, I think this should work. I don't see any problems with this.
Listeners, gentle listeners, if you're like, what the hell is he talking about? I have notes. Oh my goodness, do I have notes. If you would like to read those notes, then go to the website and they'll be there ready for you in this under this episode. Tell me where I'm wrong, because this is all made up.
What? Welcome to the Walk of Shame, where Greg doesn't have any Walk of Shames for me, and I have a whole bunch.
Basically, especially after that one. You can't Walk of Shame me about the golden goose, thank you very much. Oh, you probably can. They probably will.
They 100% will. First Walk of Shame. You mentioned that space was 3 degrees Kelvin.
Yes.
Tim points out there's no such thing as 3 degrees
you're
Kelvin.
Right, you're right, yes.
Only
Kelvin.
3 Kelvin.
Absolutely right. Yes, it's very dumb of me. Thank you. No, thank you very much for pointing that out. You're absolutely correct. Yes, yes.
And now Tim and Greg have to do a walk of shame together because you don't say 3 Kelvin. Kelvin is pluralized as required. So the temperature in deep space is roughly 3 Kelvins.
Well, there you go. Is it? I've never heard anyone use Kelvins. Interesting.
Yeah, so everyone's wrong, except for me.
Interesting.
No look of shame for the Dan.
There you go.
This next one is for me.
Excellent. Yay!
A long, long time ago, I talked about how our inner ear resonates at middle C and that certain ratios of change formed perfect harmonies and that humans like this and that not doing this formed discordant sound that we don't like. Mm. It was all quite mathematical and it sounded right. But researchers from Cambridge and Princeton have found that humans do not prefer chords that are perfect ratios. Ooh. Dr. Peter Harrison said, we prefer slight amounts of deviation. Ooh. We like a little imperfection because this gives life to the sounds and that is attractive to us. Now, I suspect this has to do with anticipation. Ooh. Anticipation is important to music. You want to pick a root note and then play around that root note and then land back on it to resolve it. If you leave it hanging, it forms tension. Being almost on the note and then moving to another note that may or may not be exactly harmonic may make music kind of Skinner box where we are constantly having the tension created and resolved. But the researchers went on to discuss non-harmonic instruments like the bonong. The bonong is one of those Asian instruments that you associate with mysticism. That sort of gong, gong, gong. I'm probably doing a racist there. I think I'm doing a racist.
Okay, that's right.
But you know the music I'm talking about. So these throw Western ideas of musical harmony out the window. So I shall take a walk of shame, and I'll be sharing that walk with Pythagoras, who first proposed the idea of perfect harmonies, so I'm in good company.
It's all right. He was killed by soldiers for just being there, really. They came and killed him, and he asked them to get out of his light, supposedly. That's probably apocryphal, but it's a great story. Soldier comes to kill you and you're scratching something on the floor and they come over, what do you have to say for yourself? Could you get out of my light, please? And they're like, oh, and they stab you to death.
Get right over there. And then so he moved to another part of the room and stabbed him.
Lobbed the spear at
him. Pythagoras joke. Jesse notes that I said Jesus died for our sins, not his own sins. That's a mistake I made last time, is I accidentally said that Jesus died for his sins.
Oh, right.
And then I went, no, Jesus died for our sins, right. Not his.
Yes.
but he reckons that technically Jesus committed the mortal sin of suicide by refusing to actively avoid death when he knew that it was approaching, which is an interesting idea that immediately comes undone when you realize that the concept of suicide as a mortal sin is a Christian concept and Jesus was Jewish. Now, Orthodox Jews also believe suicide is a sin, but they didn't exist until the 1800s. Some Jewish literature recommends compassion for the victim and survivors and actually promotes the concept of martyrs in certain instances. So there you go. Jesus is still without sin, and Jewish people, kill yourselves if you want to. You know, that didn't sound great, being spoken aloud. I feel like I may have... Have I done a racist?
That feels... especially right now.
I think
now,
I've done another racist.
Especially right now. That just... No.
Why? What's happening right now?
What do you mean, what's happening right now? Oh, my God.
You have been listening to Dan at smartenough.org.
And Greg at smartenough.org.
You can get along to the website where you can sign up as a patron to our Patreon account and then give your money to my goal of building a statue on the moon.
Through or our goose drink factory.
Yeah, that's going to be the moneymaker. If you are a second tier patron, then we thank you very, very much. We thank all of our patrons, but the second tier are the best tier.
Yeah.
So a big thank you to Andrew Potts, Andrew Trousdale, Andrew Whitehurst, Avi Greenbury, Britta Rogowski, Ivan, Ilana Mitchell, Gary Heather, Ronya Maguire, Lindsay Jenkinson, Liz Y, Mariana Scott, Scott Ewers, Matthew Toy, and Steve Stewart. I think that's thank the first you. Time I've ever done that in alphabetical order. Because I ran out of time to shuffle them. We have tier three patrons. A big thank you to them. And also, I insult you. So I have been playing Tony Hawk on my Nintendo Switch. So these insults are about skateboarding. So, Steve Eichenhout, dealing with you, it's such a grind.
Oh, good, good.
Tom Siri, your pop shouldn't have shoved it.
Oh, gross.
Yeah.
My brain just worked out what that meant. Oh, yeah. Gross.
And finally, Mikhail Kidar, who's quite sensibly has left the top tier. I'd already written the insult before I worked that out. So
he'd make you run for it, yeah.
This is a freebie, Michael. I used to think you were a complete loser, but I've done a complete 360. And a big thank you to these top-tier patrons, Al Batson, Joey Wesley, Michael Barnes, Morden O'Hare, Scott Driscoll, and Eric Wilson. You can drop in whenever you want. Asterisk. Do not come to my house. This is just a skateboarding pun. A video game that I worked on called Autoforge has gone to early access, so you can play it, and whenever you're climbing up and down ladders, you can go, oh, Dan did that.
Oh, that sounds exciting.
So check out Autoforge on Steam.
Nice. Put a link into the show notes.
I will.
Yeah.
Also, the show notes will have links to all the other stuff that we talked about as well, because we don't just make this stuff up. We actually look things up.
Absolutely.
We're good boys.
Keep the science flowing, baby.
And as we always like to say,
Gaza, Dan, Gaza!
And I've learned something important about biographies, and that is I can skip the first third of any biography. I have no interest in learning about celebrities when they were children because it's always the same story. I was a kid and I guess I just sort of kept my head down, but then I was a bit mischievous in this one incident and then I just sort of just did okay in my school way, and then I got a little bit, I did a sort of a short story and had a little bit of success, but then I didn't do anything for 12 years. And now finally, it's like chapter four, and you can actually start reading about something interesting.
I guess unless they've had an interesting childhood, or grew up in a weird spot, or...
I mean, I mentioned Drew Barrymore's biography. The first third of that is probably off the chart. I imagine it hits a point a third of the way through where it starts to just coast downhill. That first third is going to be messed up.
when she met E.T.
When she met LSD, I think it's
D. Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah. E.T. could be E's in her tea.
Oh yeah, you know it works, that's a joke. Hey, good start, off to a good start.
Did it, everyone. It's the first third that Dan normally misses, but he's enjoyed it this time, thank god.
Phew.